You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire. Mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapare Thursday. I'm your host Jessica and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by our producer Rowan. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show for our regular catch-up with Labour MP Andrew Little. We'll be speaking about how more than 6,300 overseas workers joining Aotearoa's health workforce in the past year, as well as expansions to working visas for New Zealand and UK residents. I also talked to Professor of Medicine and Acting Dean of Medical and Health Sciences at the University of Auckland, Waipapa Taumatarau, Walrick Baggs, about the need for more medical students and why the university is against National's proposal to have a third medical school at the University of Waikato. And for Get Action, Otago University Students Association President Quinton Jane and Victoria University of Wellington Students Association President Jessica Yee discussed their petition to make tertiary education more accessible and introduce a universal study wage for all. Rowan, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to screenwriter and associate professor Shuchi Kothari about the Pan-Asian Screen Collective and the initiative to have more Asian stories on screen.
Hey, aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ke eni kōrero āno he pakihere Rocky Rocky Mārunga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. And you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Immigration Minister Andrew Little recently announced that in 1 year, more than 6,300 overseas health workers have joined Aotearoa's health workforce through the government's accredited employer work visa scheme and the green list straight to residence pathways. The UK working holiday visa was also extended on July 1st to allow people in the UK aged 18 to 35 to stay and work in Aotearoa for up to 3 years. This follows similar changes to the UK's youth mobility scheme, which will now allow New Zealanders aged 18 to 30 to live and work in the UK for up to 2 years. I spoke to Little about both of these announcements and started by asking him to explain the purpose of new residency pathways.
Can you explain to our listeners what these two pathways are and their purpose?
The accredited employer work visa is the employer gets the right to hire offshore and minimises the level of sort of bureaucracy that they end, in this case health workers, would have to go through to get a visa to work here. We obviously have a big shortage of health workers in our health system, like many countries around the world, so we have to recruit offshore. We've been doing that. So in the last year since the borders opened, even though we actually had recruited health workers during the pandemic and when the lockdown was in place, we've had over 6,000 more health workers join our workforce. Probably about 2,500 of those have arrived in New Zealand since that time. The others were health workers who were in New Zealand already on another visa, either on a visitor's visa or some other visa that didn't entitle them to work, but because they were, had the right to work or work in their chosen area of health work, they could get a relevant work visa to do that. So it's helping us fill the gaps that we've got. We've still got a long way to go, but we have a health system that's always relied on overseas workers. We've just got to make it as easy as possible to get here, and the system that we've set up looks like it's working and achieving that.
Can you give any insight into how you believe these pathways have improved health outcomes?
The main thing is building our health workforce. I mean, this government has funded a lot of extra positions in our health system. We knew, even when we first became government in 2017, we were short of a lot of nurses. We still are, and we're short of a lot of other health senior health clinicians. So we have to, we're recruiting offshore. The more we do to fill the gaps that we've got, then that means that hospitals can cover the shifts they've got and the vacancies in the shifts. It keeps pressure off the workforce who are here. I mean, one of the challenges we've had, certainly since COVID, with a reduced workforce is the same amount of work, in fact, more work, gets heaped on a smaller workforce, and that just puts pressure and stress on everybody. So that constant effort to fill the gaps that we've got, including recruiting offshore, is alleviating that that undue pressure on the rest of the health workforce. As I say, look, we've still got a ways to go, and there's and recruiting offshore doesn't mean we need to reduce the effort to create our own as well. So recently we've announced more places in particularly our nursing colleges. So we will produce more of our own nurses. That's a longer term prospect, obviously, but we will continue to produce our own as well.
And it's been reported that the SIS has said that it's dealing with an almost 200% increase in checks for residence visas, that half of the fast-track green list residence applications for medical, engineering and IT jobs are waiting for security checks and taking an average of 6 months to process these. So how are you planning to address these delays and speed up the processing time so people can enter the workforce quicker?
Yeah, look, I'm not familiar with those figures. There's some visa applications from some countries need to go through an extra check. The information I have is that even with those applications that need extra checks, the turnaround time is on average a matter of a month or so, 20 working days. So I need to go back and check those particular figures. Across all applications, the clearance time is somewhere between 10 and 20 working days. There's a lot that get processed through. There are some that take a long time. So the median number is bigger than that. We have about 1,000 people dedicated to visa processing, including those here as holiday makers, those who are coming here to work, and those who are here for a residency, and they process those just as quickly as they can.
And the government has faced some criticism for not initially putting some high-demand professions, including nurses, on the straight to residence category initially. This was done in December last year. So looking back, do you think that this should have been done sooner?
When I look at the number of nurses who've got the straight to residency visa, it's since then, it's 19. It was never clear that that was the critical difference to attracting nurses here. Things like pay, things like working conditions are just as if not more important. And as we've increased nurse pay and we've become more attractive, I think what it's meant is a lot of people who were already here under different visas have seen the attractiveness of working in a health system. We'll continue to recruit offshore, and no doubt that number of straight to residency nurses will pick up, but it hasn't been a huge number even since we made the change.
I also wanted to discuss with you an extension to the UK working holiday visa, as well as similar changes to the UK's youth mobility scheme. So can you explain what this will mean for eligible young New Zealanders and when this is coming into effect?
It took effect from 1 July, so last weekend. It means that folks can spend longer in respective countries doing work. So it's not unusual for young New Zealanders in particular to travel to the UK, do some work, spend some time working. So what was previously a two-year period is now extended to 3 years that they can work for. The age has increased as well. So it used to cut out at in the late 20s. It's now up to 35. You can be there up to 35 under that particular work visa. So it creates more opportunities, and likewise for Brits coming here, they'll benefit from the scheme as well, from those extensions.
So how will this help fill labour shortages in both countries?
Well, for New Zealand in particular, I mean, we've been reliant on young it's a holiday, working holiday folks to fill gaps in our hospitality industry and seasonal industries like the ski industry. A lot of young overseas workers tend to work in those industries because they're short-term and seasonal. For those sectors, and they have been crying out for more people, it'll make a huge difference to them.
And how many people do you expect to take up this offer from the UK?
We think about 3,000 Brits who are currently in New Zealand who will benefit from it. I'm not quite sure what the numbers are overall, but we do get a large number who want to come down here. Often do it as part of a gap year or as once they've finished their tertiary studies and want to take a bit of extra time. We've been an enormous beneficiary of it. So the numbers will grow and it will continue to make a difference.
And the UK's conditions for New Zealanders are somewhat more restrictive in terms of both the age range and the length of the visa. So in the UK, New Zealanders living in the UK would have to be between 18 and 30 and only have a two-year period for the specific visa. So have there been discussions about possibly extending this to match what we're offering?
I expect over time we will do that. I think this will come up during the negotiation of the free trade agreement with the UK. So the agreement, these agreements on these working holiday visas was sort of kind of a side agreement to the free trade agreement. As I think trade lifts and the relationship strengthens between ourselves and the UK, we'll revisit the conditions around the working holiday visas, particularly for Kiwis in the UK, and I'm confident that over time we'll see improvements in that.
And just lastly, there's been some criticism from the opposition in particular that we shouldn't be encouraging New Zealanders to go overseas and that New Zealand isn't perhaps an attractive place for what is being called high potential individuals to live and work. So what would you say to these sorts of claims?
Look, it's good that New Zealanders like to travel and want to travel. Most New Zealanders, young New Zealanders who travel, come back and bring back skills that they've learned overseas and experiences and insights they've learned overseas. That's good for us. It's been almost a rite of passage for many young New Zealanders to do that. So we're not going to discourage that. We think it's good for them, and in the long run, it's good for all of New Zealand.
That was Immigration Minister Andrew Little discussing immigration changes for overseas health workers and UK and New Zealand residents.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. We appreciate all your texts. Text in on 5395 or call in on 309 3879.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, is back for 2023. The world's best filmmakers are bringing their latest creations to Aotearoa, from major award winners and nominees to creations from our very own soil. This is the perfect opportunity to see some truly excellent films. Grab yourself a festival guide from participating venues and create your ultimate NZIFF experience. Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, July 19th to August 6th. Tickets and info available at nziff.co.nz.
Ever gazed at the seemingly never-ending landscape of the sky, wondering just what might be beyond planet Earth? Uncover its mysteries and magnitude this month with Tūhura Tuarangi, Aotearoa in Space.
Learn and play with out-of-this-world activities that showcase space technology and the world-leading research going on right here in Aotearoa.
Get your hands crafting and mind sharpening with fun and facts for the whole whānau.
Play, build, launch and explore the origins of our night sky this July at MOTAT. Find out more at motat.nz.
95BFM and Hendrix Gin presents Elemental Jazz at Neck of the Woods. Two nights of new jazz. Night one, Saturday, July 22nd, features Clearpath Ensemble and the Arjuna Oaks Band with DJs Kenny Sterling and Hudge. Night 2, Friday, August 4, features the world live debut of The Lahar and support from Phoebe Rings with DJs Carlotta and Hudge. 95BFM and Hendrix Gin presents Elemental Jazz at Neck of the Woods, Saturday, July 22 and Friday, August 4. Get your tickets now from TicketFairy.com.
95BFM and Under the Radar present Dimmer, live at the Power Station. Following the sold-out success of the Transcendent I Believe You Are a Star tour, Dimmer's stellar six-piece lineup will reconvene to perform a stunning, shiny new set. A melting pot of sonic exploration. Do not miss Dimmer live. 95BFM and Under the Radar present Dimmer December 2nd at the Power Station. Tickets and info at AAAticketing.co.nz.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morning, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show. Bring stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago.
The 95BFM Kids Show with Lee and Finn, 7 till 9 every Sunday morning. Brought to you by the New Zealand Maritime Museum. Hui te ananui a Tangaroa.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The Pan-Asian Screen Collective is a not-for-profit organization based in Aotearoa that was founded in 2018 by University of Auckland Associate Professor Shuchi Kothari to promote equity for Pan-Asian representation on New Zealand screens. The initiative allows for selected students, staff, and alumni to create a pilot episode representing the Pan-Asian community in their own way. I spoke to screenwriter and associate professor Shuchi Kothari about the success and of the initiative has had, and recent pilots that have been created.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Pan-Asian Screen Collective and the work that you and the team have recently put out?
In 2018, Selena Zhou, Roseanne Liang, Gilbert Wong, and myself, the four of us, co-founded the Pan-Asian Screen Collective because for many years, you know, it was very clear that Asians have had a marginal, or I should say marginalized position. So we needed to mobilize, we needed to become visible, we needed to advocate, and we needed to create opportunities for a very large constituency that felt it was not anywhere near feeling welcome to produce work either for film or television. So the purpose of the Pan-Asian Screen Collective was advocacy and training, and that's what we've been primarily doing since 2018. We've had some amazing outcomes, and episode one, you know, the last big program that we did was part of that.
What was the recent program that you put out about? What was the story?
I think it was in 2021, perhaps, at the start of 2021. I'd spoken to my board, core board members, that I would like to design a program a bit like the pilot season in the United States, but a capacity-building program where we would fund maybe 16 to develop a pilot for a web series and to produce a pilot for a web series. But it would be held like a course, almost a one-year course, where there would be lectures and there'd be workshops and there would be a scaffolded development of each team's idea so that they could feel supported as they moved forward. And the board was really, you know, very responsive, even though it was a rather ambitious notion. And then I spoke to New Zealand On Air, which is the primary funding body in New Zealand for television or, you know, online platform, but not film. And Amy May is the head of dramatic funding. She really took to the idea and managed to get funding from the Ministry of Culture and Heritage. So it was a fantastic, you know, initiative. It worked really well. We had a beautiful team. We produced lovely work, and yes, it was hard because even though, you know, to an ordinary person, $75,000 for a pilot might seem like a lot of money, it's not a lot of money when you're actually making a show. So everyone, you know, have to kind of also learn how to handle budgets. They have to learn everything from kind of casting, teamwork, building an idea, making a pitch deck, the whole gamut. Finally, everyone pitched their series to industry stakeholders and to commissioners and producers, and we had a screening, and It was a really, really, it was a program with fabulous, you know, uptake, both in terms of the participants, but also people in the industry. And some of those programs, you know, fingers crossed, will be moving forward and visible on our television screen.
Can you give us some examples of some of the stories that were pitched?
And there was a team of, I think, five who had property that they developed as a stage play called Boom Shankar. And Bala and Aman took that and said, oh, we'd like to do this as a web series. So it was about a totally net bomb diffuser expert who comes to defuse a bomb at a dairy, and instead of defusing the bomb, ends up killing himself and the dairy owner. And the whole series is an afterlife, as these two men who can't stand each other have to then learn to deal with each other. So it was a friendship, you know, essentially about friendship and kind of second chances. We had another wonderful, a genre piece about the politics around cryogenics and who has the right to keep someone alive once they're dead, you know, what the science, it's a science fiction piece, beautifully done by Asuka Silvi and Emma Mortimer, the team of two. We also had a team called Asian Age, which was a, you know, high school experience in a posh private school about what it is to be a young Asian woman navigating the, you know, racial politics, but also just being a teenager. And what does that mean when you are same and you're different? There was also a wonderful story about a young kleptomaniac, a woman who brilliantly played by Zana Tan, by a team of four, and the director Pon and the writing Chen had this great character about a young woman who's kind of broken and is a porch pirate who pinches, you know, parcels from people's porches. And then she accidentally, you know, ends up picking up an urn, and then the urn, spoiler alert, comes to life, and it's about morality. Another kind of buddy film, you know, but a different take between two young women in their 20s figuring out what the right thing to do is. We had a great project about a biracial Chinese Pakeha family called Happiness is the Path, where Chai Ling and Natasha Daniels was one of the writers of this kind of Chai Ling story, about, you know, what it is to be growing up biracial in a family. And they took a take of, you know, a dysfunctional family where the father just suddenly decides one day that he's going to become a monk, leaving the three adult kids who suddenly realize that something wrong with their family that they've never resolved. So the stories are very, very, though they are Asian stories told by primarily Asian creatives, they're very universal ideas, and that's something that people in the room that day, you know, the producers from production companies in New Zealand and the commissioners, they could pick up on that, that these are very universal stories, which is true, because the more specific you are, the more universal you become.
Now, thinking more generally, how do you think this initiative and other representations of ethnic minorities in the screen impacts immigrant communities?
I think representation is important, period, right? Whatever community, if you live in this country, you're part of its landscape, and you need to have opportunities to tell your stories, to see yourself on screen, to see people like you on screen speaking, you know, to you and with you. I think this is very important, irrespective of who you are. You know, we could talk about rainbow communities or Pacifica communities or Asian communities, or, of course, you know, most foundationally, Māori. It's who we are in New Zealand, right? We need to have a more honest sense of who we are, where we live, on our screen. So in that sense, I feel representation isn't a favour. It's not someone's goodwill. It's just a honest reflection of where we live. The impact is not just on immigrant communities. The impact is on everyone, right? To turn a program on and to see something that makes us feel or think or be moved is why we watch. We watch to be entertained. We watch to understand. We watch to learn. And that can come from anyone. So, you know, I know there's a whole argument about social cohesion, that if immigrants see themselves on the screen, it kind of makes the society more cohesive. But I think it's, in a way, beyond that. I think it's what we owe ourselves as a people, is to reflect and celebrate our stories. And that just means all New Zealand stories.
That was screenwriter and associate professor Shuchi Kathari on the Pan-Asian Screen Collective and creating opportunities to represent Asian communities on the screen.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
In an effort to increase the number of medical student placements, the National Party recently announced that they would create a third medical school at the University of Waikato if elected. However, the University of Auckland, Waipapa Taumata Row, have said this would not be the most cost-effective or efficient way of increasing the number of future doctors. I spoke to Professor of Medicine and Acting Dean of Medical and Health Sciences at the University of Auckland, Warwick Bagg, and started off the interview asking for his thoughts on National's policy.
We all agree that we need more medical students to be training, and the government has recently announced an additional 50 students across the country. They've also announced the number of students that they need to train over time to meet the medical workforce shortage. So I think we've all agreed that we need more students. What we also all agreed on is that we're operating in fiscally constrained times, so therefore we need to do this in the most cost-efficient way. And so I guess our argument would be that the most cost-efficient way would be to use the existing infrastructure of the universities to train these additional medical students.
So can you tell us where the University of Auckland or other universities train medical students and how many places are offered around the country?
Okay, so I'll talk particularly from a Waipapa Taumata Row perspective, which is we have had our class size increased to 287 for next year, and we train all the way from Whakatane across to Taranaki and up to Kaitaia and everywhere in between. We have about 150 students every year moving through Hamilton, at training at Waikato Hospital, and then a number of other places in the mid-North Island, including Rotorua, Tauranga, as I've already mentioned, Taranaki, and then in small rural places, Thames, Raglan, Taupo, Narawahia, in general practices. So that's not to mention all that we do in Northland. So we train extensively across the upper North Island.
Why do you believe that adding a new medical school at the University of Waikato wouldn't be the best option for training more medical students?
The principal reason is that we need to get the best use of taxpayer money. Medical students are expensive to train, and rather than investing the $380 million in capital expenditure that's required to set up a new medical school, let's invest that in medical students themselves. And Waipapa Taumata Row is certainly willing to take more medical students without that huge capital infrastructure uplift.
We've seen, like you mentioned, that the government recently announced that 50 more medical students would be allowed to be taken in each year. How many students is the university able to take in?
Well, so next year we're aiming for a class size of around 330, which includes up to 30 international students. And then we're looking to go further. So the National Party announced another 50 students in 2025 across the country, so we would welcome those students and add them to our cohort. And then we're having a big discussion, given the announcement a couple of days ago about what Te Whata Ora and Te Aka Whai Ora see as the number of new doctors they need to train and to how many we need to train. So that's the discussion we're having at the moment as to where we might land with that number.
The university has been calling for increased medical student places for some time. What has delayed this from happening?
You're absolutely right. We started asking in 2017 the then national government, and then have been repeatedly asking since then. I think fundamentally it comes down to the cost of training medical students. It's very expensive training. But what we've seen displayed recently is a real will by the government to fund those places, and so we're delighted that they've made a step in that direction. And again, I come back to the fact that Te Whatu Ora and Te Aka Whai Ora have outlined what they think the gap is and what they need to do to fill it, and so if we follow through with those expectations, then we're going to have many more medical students training, which is really good news.
And what is this going to mean for students hoping to pursue medicine?
Well, the more places that we have available, the greater the opportunity for them to enter medicine, and that's got to be a good thing. Medicine's got a very strict entry cap on it set by the government, and we have extremely strong interest, and we'd love to offer more places. We just need the government to agree to that.
And what initiatives are in place at Waipapa Taumata Rau to ensure that there are more Māori and Pacific doctors in Aotearoa?
So we begin in high school with our Whakapikiaki program, which supports Māori rangatahi to continue to take the important subjects that will set them up for success in health professions. So continuing to do science, English, those sorts of subjects. Then we have a Hikatia Taora certificate that helps to bridge the gap between school and first year. And then we have a Māori and Pacific support scheme for Māori and Pacific students to ensure that they have academic success while they study medicine. And we have an affirmative pathway that allows Māori and Pacific students to enter the medical program. So we have a whole pipeline effect to ensure that we grow the numbers of Māori and Pacific students over time, and we are seeing that successfully happen.
And what would your message be to the government or any incoming government when it comes to addressing the medical student shortage?
Both major parties have signalled that they want to increase medical student numbers, and we welcome that. Our message would be, let's talk about how we do that in the most cost-effective and cost-efficient way.
That is Professor Warwick Bagg from the University of Auckland discussing how we can increase medical student placements in Aotearoa.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Teenage Fan Club at the Power Station Friday, March 15. Blown in by the wind, Scottish Indie Icons Teenage Fan Club will return to New Zealand in March 2024 in celebration of their reflective new album, Nothing Lasts Forever.
It's time to move along.
Teenage Fan Club, Friday, March 15 at the Power Station. Tickets on sale Monday from frontiertouring.com.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
DJs Phoebe HL, Malika and Kirsty Sutherland.
And tomorrow,
the Party Kapara Project, followed by Chip Matthews and Soul Trey.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Is there a nice dinner place in town?
Well, you know Jenny from Spanish class?
Yeah.
She was sitting next to me every day until eventually I got up the courage and asked her out to Mezi Bar.
So, Mezi Bar.
It never really worked out. We wanted different things. I guess that's the beauty of tapas.
Mezi Bar. Great food, great drinks, great memories. Your Mediterranean oasis right in the centre of town, Durham Street East. For hours and info, go to mezibar.co.nz.
Experience the Hemp Store at 253 Karangahape Road. For nationwide delivery, visit hempstore.co.nz or call 0800 Hemp Store.
For the best in hemp, you gotta keep it green. The Hemp Store on K Road is what you need.
Okay, mate, I got one for you.
Yep, yep.
For $1 billion, you just have to complete one impossible task.
I can do anything.
You have to remain idle at an idol show.
anything but that.
Idols are coming to town to bring the heat to Spark Arena as part of Elemental Nights 2023, and we're giving away tickets. So get your B-card number and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive. Idols at Spark Arena, July 21. Get your tickets now from ticketmaster.co.nz.
Science. Science is all around us. This rock... Hello. Yeah, I'm voicing it now. Still on Tuesday? Change of host? Not toast, host. I don't mention... Right. But where do we go to find out about more science?
Dear Science, join the Tuesday Wire team as they speak to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs chatting about discoveries, controversies and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Otago University President Quentin Jane and Victoria University of Wellington Students Association Te Aka Tauira President Jessica Yee have launched a petition to make tertiary education more accessible and introduce a universal study wage for all. For Get Action this week, I spoke to Quentin and Jessica about why they believe this is necessary. First, Quentin answers this question, followed by Jessica.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
I think the best place to start with that would be to question why you wouldn't want to make study more accessible. And I don't think there's a sensible answer to that. I think that making study more accessible simply means that more people are able to access higher education, which would be a good thing for everyone. And so one of the best ways that I can think of to do that would be to make it possible to live while you study, so that studying becomes a viable option for anyone in Aotearoa. And so that's why I think we need a study wage for all, to ensure that anyone who wants to study can study without the financial pressures of having to work, having to borrow, or having to rely on family for support.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just total the sentiment that we should be actually questioning why normalised student poverty is our status quo. We've gotten to a state where universities are increasingly becoming, and tertiary education as well, has become increasingly a pathway for the middle class and upper classes. And so we should actually be questioning, you know, why shouldn't this actually be more openly accessible to everyone? And so I think a universal study wage is key to providing that opportunity to students and future students.
What would this look like, making tertiary education more accessible?
Our study wage for all does mean that anyone who wants to study can go and study, has a guaranteed income that is not indebting themselves into the future. And it also means that they don't have to go into study with this kind of predetermined outcome that they need to get this degree to get a job. You can go and study to enrich yourselves and to upskill in the areas that would be meaningful to you and gain the other life skills that come from university. So I think that when we look at a study wage for all, it makes it accessible to anyone for any reason. And that's kind of the key, I think, behind this piece of work.
Definitely. I would also just quickly add that a lot of students are really concerned about how they're going to live in the now, how are they going to make their ends meet day to day. And so this is separate to, say, any efforts to reduce tuition fees or any effort to wipe tuition fees. But we think that one of the largest barriers to students being able to live well and also stay and study is the daily cost of living pressures. And those are the most immediate pressures on students. And so that's why we're campaigning on a study wage for all, which is a weekly payment to students that would support them to live with dignity and actually focus on their studies rather than being stretched so tightly over working to make ends meet and paying rent and then also trying to balance their studies, because we've seen so many students drop out at the moment due to the high cost of living.
What, in your opinion, has changed in the past few decades about being a student that people who haven't studied in a while might not understand?
It depends how far you back you're going with a few decades, but if you go back just a few decades, you get to the point where there were no student loans and you got a bursary to study. And now we've flipped that on its head and there are student loans and you have to borrow to study. And so that's quite a different experience for students, because if you were living on a relatively modest income, but you weren't borrowing from your future self, it didn't, you know, it was okay to kind of have to make those sacrifices because it was free to do that. But now when you're having to borrow from your future self, it's pretty rough to be living in some of the conditions that students are in, which are pretty terrible conditions, while indebting yourself at the same time. It's not very good value for money. But for students, many of them are required to work while study at the moment. We've got the cost of rent is skyrocketing for students compared to a few decades ago. So the conditions that they're in are considerably worse for the costs that they've got. And I think that's why we need to look at something like a study wage for all, to kind of reset the balance on the scales there, to make sure that students are getting what they should be able to get when they're studying, because you shouldn't be expected to work while you're studying. When your courses are up at workload expectations of 48 hours a week, you can't be expected to do 20 hours of work on top of that. That's just unreasonable. And so I think it's that the expectations on students have grown, but the financial supports are not there to match those expectations.
Just on that, I think from memory, It was back when Quinton was talking about those bursaries. I think everyone had access to a relatively universal student allowance back then. I think the access rate was much higher, whereas right now it's only 12% of students in 2023 have access to a student allowance. And so we've seen considerable drop in the amount of people who have got access to sufficient financial support that doesn't require them to indebt themselves. And at the same time, we've seen student enrollments drop from the mid-2000s until 2023 as well. And so there's a pattern here of higher cost of livings, increasing student poverty, increasing inaccessibility of students being able to access tertiary education and stay in tertiary education. And I think it comes back to how we value education and what role we think education has in our society. And if we think education is a public good and the act of learning is something that's actually inherently valuable, then we need to properly value our students and treat their contribution of studying not as a halfway contribution to finding a job, but something as inherently valuable. It's important for us to have enriched, educated citizens.
What do you think is not working about the current student allowance scheme?
Well, the current student allowance scheme, only 12% of students, I think it is, are actually eligible for the full student allowance. And, you know, broadening on that, only one third of students actually get any form of allowance, and the average amount they get is less than half. So the majority of students are having to borrow to live. And that is incredibly unfair for many students who would be right on that threshold, because this is determined by your parental income. But of course, different families might be in different positions for how they can support their children. And to arbitrarily cap it without any consideration for any other mitigating factors on a family's income is unfair to students. And that's why we need the study wage, so that every student is entitled to the same thing, that they are guaranteed that full living support while they study and don't have to rely on parents, don't have to rely on work, and don't kind of create this hierarchical education system that means students from well-off families can succeed better while they study.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are also other criteria to the current student allowance scheme that we also consider inequitable. For example, postgraduate students can't access student allowances right now either, which is, to be honest, just downright exploitative that they're not able to access student allowance because of their postgraduate status when their financial situations are often similar to undergraduate students. And that creates more inequity as well, because there's an assumption there that postgraduate students are somehow more well off when we consider the fact that we want to see more marginalized perspectives in research and academia, that leaves our marginalized communities a lot worse off in terms of accessing postgraduate study. The age eligibility limits are also another issue, and they don't recognize that poverty can be lifelong, and the fact that people might want to be able to enter tertiary education later in life and still have the opportunity. And also the partner income testing it just places unnecessary pressure on relationships and doesn't feel in step with current realities of students.
And if you feel comfortable sharing, what has your experience been like as a student with some of the challenges that universities and students are facing right now?
So part of the reason that I didn't go back and do postgraduate study this year was that I got burnt out last year trying to work and study and balance life on top of everything. And when you see your student loan climbing, but you're still working about 20 hours a week, just to kind of be able to live with more dignity than just trying to rely on the loan, it's just really tiring and it's not fair. And in Dunedin, when I first started university 5 years ago, you used to be able to live within, you know, pretty tight means, but you could live with some comfort on the student loan. But with the increases in food costs and rent in Dunedin in particular, it's not manageable anymore for most students to live with any sense of dignity on the current student loan. And so more people are picking up work and they're tiring themselves out. And so something like this, where I wouldn't see my student loan climbing and where I'd be able to actually study without working and focus on my studies, would have been incredibly beneficial. And I'd be doing a master's degree right now.
And yeah, definitely for myself, my rent last year was $270. And so I had to study part-time and work part-time because my rent was just so expensive, and cost of living with food and stuff as well. So I've had to take time off from studying to just manage myself. But I also know that a lot of other people have had to take on full-time work and full-time study, which is just insane. And I feel like there's a perception that, oh, students just have to tough it out for the time that they're in university. But that's actually not true, because actually the amount of time it takes students to pay debt off, pay their student loans off, is much longer than you anticipate. And that's it. That prevents you from your next steps in your life, whether it's postgraduate study or whether it's setting down roots or like wanting to go overseas or anything like that. So it's an experience of burnout, and that's something that, yeah, it isn't good for people, and it means that it takes an impact on the academic performance as well, on their well-being. And it just, when we're thinking about the fact that universities and tertiary education are supposed to set students up for the future, it doesn't feel like you're being really well set up.
We saw that members of government, like the current Prime Minister Chris Hipkins and Grant Robertson, had previously advocated for a universal student allowance. What would your message be to them now?
I really just want to remind them that they were student politicians and that they've campaigned on these things, and that student poverty has only got worse since they were in student politics. Grant Robertson held my job 30 years ago, and I'd really like him to just kind of take a step back, reflect, and then also listen to the stories that are coming out from current students, understand the situation that we're in at the moment. He's welcome to come. We'll go for a walk down Castle Street and find his old flat, and he can see the conditions that students are in and why a study wage for all would be so great for so many students in Aotearoa.
Yeah, my message isn't that different. Chris Hipkins was in my role, I think, 21 or 22 years ago. And yeah, student poverty has only worsened. And I'd say that they just really need to take courage and just stay true to their roots. You know, like, we want to see them have integrity and mean what they used to mean before they, you know, enter parliament. And I think now is the time for transformational change with them at the helm, and it's only going to get worse if there's no action. So it really does feel like there aren't any more excuses with them at the helm of our nation. You would really like to see transformative change.
That was Student Association's presidents Quinton and Jessica discussing the need for a universal student allowance.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrerum ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpiti Thursday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.